Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Hitting a round ball with a stick, then running around the bases to score a point. That's called baseball, the all-American game, but it was regularly played at one of the least American of places in the nation, the Crystal City internment camp. There, baseball was a daily part of life for Germans and Japanese and other residents who were held there without due process and in violation of their rights. We're joined by Ebhart Ebb Fuhrer, who lived it, and he was at the internment camp. And also with us is Greg Garrett. He is the education specialist at the Institute of Texan Culture, where you are looking at the connection between the Texas and the German community and baseball there, Greg. So that's really interesting. And our phone lines are open if you've got a question or a comment as we talk about German and baseball connection, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. And Eb, it's great to have you here, sir.
Well, it's always good to be with you, and I appreciate the communications I've had with Greg and the San Antonio newspaper.
Yeah, and I don't know if you remember or not, but I interviewed you. I did a story on you about 10 years ago at Crystal City, and when you were out there speaking to the residents and talking about your experiences out there.
Yeah, I was definitely out there. Has it been 10 years? The time really flies.
Yeah, I think it was 9. Time does fly, and we're going to have that story posted on our website that I did with you, because a lot of people are not familiar with the fact that there were many German residents and German Americans who were put into the internment camps during World War II. And particularly shocking was that the Germans were considered to be the biggest minority in America at the time, and yet they were still imprisoned.
Yeah, you know, but there were also Germans brought up from Central and Latin America for internment at Crystal City. So it really enhanced our culture by having them there as well.
I remember you telling me that when you grew up, where was that, in Ohio? Where was that?
I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. I was brought in from 1928 until I was arrested in March of 1943.
Right, that the FBI went to your high school class and pulled you out of your high school class, dropped you out, and then when they got you outside the front door, they put you in cuffs and put you in back of the car, and you were never to return. Just like that.
That's right.
And you were just a kid born... you weren't born in the United States, right?
No, I was born in a suburb of Cologne called Leverkusen, and I was 3 years old when my parents brought me to Cincinnati, along with my older brother. And my younger brother was born in Cincinnati in 1929.
And then you eventually found your way in the camp, and you came from a working class family, and you know, not really connected to anything, and somehow you found yourself mixed up in here. And even after the war ended, still inside the camp for what, 2 years?
I was in Crystal City from July 1943 until April of 1947, when they sent me to Ellis Island. to be deported under an order issued by Harry Truman, the president.
So, Eb, do you ever think about some of the stuff that's happening today and, you know, some of the issues and stuff, and think about your own experiences?
Well, it's very reminiscent of the time. In 1940, we were asked to, every alien non-citizen was required to register in 1940, regardless from what country they were from, as long as they were 14 years of age or older, male or female. They had to register, say, I'm from Australia, I'm from Germany, I'm from Mexico, I'm from Canada, or wherever, and you were issued a number, and you had to offer up your thumbprint.
So you ended up, I guess, through, was it just chance, or you just, because you were a nice guy, you didn't end up getting deported? You were allowed to stay in the United States.
Well, the thing is, when they sent me to Ellis Island for deportation, The United States Senate sent the subcommittee on the judiciary to hold hearings on Ellis Island about the remaining internees at the time, which was 2 years after the war ended. And that resulted in a Senate bill called S-1649, issued by Senator Langer, and it demanded of the then Attorney General, Tom C. Clark, that we be released forthwith. And I was released in September of 47, about 2 months later.
You were released, you were how old, and what resources did you have?
Well, I was arrested when I was 17, and I was released when I was 22. And so when I was released, I worked for a year selling insecticide in New York City. And then I was married a year after I was released to the gal I met in Crystal City, who was also there with her parents. And but she was born in New York City. And I was able to get a scholarship to Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota, and I did my freshman year there, and then I transferred to Ohio University, where I graduated with highest honors in January of 1952.
Do you want to go on to work for the Chrysler Company? Is that right? Retired from there eventually?
No, after college, I went to work for Shell Oil Company.
Okay.
In sales and marketing, and I started in Akron and then Youngstown, where all three of my kids were born, and I was transferred to Cincinnati as the merchandising manager, which was kind of a sales promotion managership, and I was then transferred to Rochester, New York, and I left Shell Oil Company in 1964 to pursue a master's degree at the University of Wisconsin, and after that, I was employed by Consolidated Papers, and later they sold us to Pioneer Plastics, and my career then was selling laminated plastics, and I ended up my career as a national sales manager for architectural products of decorative high-pressure laminates.
Okay, so during all this time, when you're living your life and you're raising your family and earning a living and dealing with basically living the American dream, what were your thoughts? I mean, how present were you? Was Crystal City? Were you able to isolate it and say, well, that happened, but it's not that big of a deal, or was it there? Was it percolating always?
Well, during my career, I didn't want to talk about it a lot because. When I was with Shell, I had the feeling that even though I passed some very big tests about industrial lubricants and things like that, I was never able to get into industrial sales with Shell because I felt that they couldn't get clearance for me to market products with the military and with big contractors that did work for the government. So I didn't talk very much about internment until I was ready to retire. Of course, it was always in the background of and I did talk about it with my children, and they knew I was interned. And about a year before I retired, we were sold to another company, and somebody said, "Well, Eb, what did you do during the war?" And I said, "Well, I was interned as a dangerous alien enemy." And the guy just fell on the floor laughing himself silly. And I figured, well, now's the time to talk about it.
Well, how did baseball, how powerful was baseball when you were there?
Well, baseball was important to me growing up in Cincinnati. I played on the high school team. I lettered twice. We lost the championship game for Cincinnati and when I was a junior, and then when I was transferred down to Crystal City, Texas, it was really the biggest way to kill time and to feel worthwhile and that kind of thing. And you got to make really good buddies with your teammates, and at the same time, we could only play against Japanese, so it was a real culture adventure to play against the Japanese, and they beat us and we beat them, and it was always good friendly competition, and so it helped while away the time. And it was also a valuable, I really love baseball, still do, and because it is my favorite sport, even though I've played basketball, not very much basketball, but soccer and football at Woodward High School, too.
And what position did you play on the baseball team?
On baseball, I was catcher. And, of course, you're in on every play. Every pitch is important, and every play is important. Your positioning of the defense and all that kind of stuff, and you get to realize who's a good batter and who isn't.
Plus, Eb's a Reds fan, so he can't be too bad.
All right, so
no, I was a Reds fan.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue our conversation. We'll bring in Greg. You just heard Greg Garrett from the Institute of Texan Culture talking about the German community in Texas and baseball. And with Eb also with us, he lived in it with the internment camp playing baseball there. A fascinating story, a story that needs to be told, and people need to know what happened to Eb and people like him, German Americans, Japanese Americans, people from Latin America who were kidnapped and brought into the United States to be in these internment camps. This story continues when we come back from the break, and you can call in with your questions, 210-614-8980. The source continues. You're listening to Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. This is The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about baseball being played here in Texas by the German communities. We know that it was an important part of the Americanization of many different ethnic groups here, and the Germans, no exception there. With us to talk about that is Greg Garrett. He's an education specialist at the Institute of Texan Culture. Also with us on the line is Eb Furr, who was at the internment camp, a German resident here in the United States, an American citizen, held there without due process for many years. And our phone lines are open if you've got a question or a comment. Number is 210-614-8980. So, Greg Garrett, how did you find Eb? How did you get his story?
To be honest, I knew of Crystal City and the Japanese teams that were already playing, and I decided I would do, I knew there were German internees, so I decided I would do just a quick Google search, German baseball at Crystal City, and bam, Eb, your photo pops up. And so from there, my colleague Lynn Jakobik at work, she told me that Jen Jarbo Russell had just written The Train to Crystal City. I was able to contact Miss Russell, and she put me in touch with Eb.
So what picture was it that turned up?
It was the shot of, 9 or 10 of y'all, Eb? I think there's 9 or 10 of them. It's his brother Julius, his younger brother Gerhard.
Yeah, there were 10 of us, Sarah, and my brother Julius is in there, and my younger brother Gary. And incidentally, there was another guy on there who got to be a PhD, and he was head of a major university's organic chemistry department.
What kind of equipment did y'all have, Eb?
Interesting.
Well, the equipment was supplied by the protecting powers. The United States and Germany both selected Switzerland as, quote, the protecting power, which would inspect all the facilities and then report back to their employer. And they supplied the books for our libraries. They supplied athletic gear like tennis balls and tennis rackets and things like that internees might need or prisoners of war might need in different facilities. And they would utilize frozen German funds here in the United States. And then they would use for prisoners of war held in Germany, they would use U.S. funds that were frozen in Germany to buy the same kind of gear for POWs in Germany.
And so you had just regulation. You're playing softball, was that right?
Yeah, we played fast pitch softball because the field was just not large enough to play baseball. And of course, baseball, and it was, and I don't think we ever really had a rule book on fast pitch softball. And we occasionally we had some real discussions about what was legitimate, what wasn't, about when one could a runner leave the base when it left the pitcher's hand or what. And so we kind of made our own rules up as it went along. And the Japanese, same way, because they didn't have a rule book either.
Any balls ever get hit over the fence and just had to just say that? That
was, the outfield was that positioned one so that you would hit toward the interior. And if any balls did go over the wall, the guards would retrieve them for us and throw them back in.
And Greg, talk about the connection between the local German community and baseball.
Well, one thing I've picked up in this research, as you know, I've been a couple of times to the source discussing Tejano baseball and also African American baseball. And I'm really started to notice once I got into the German baseball research that you talked about the Americanization. It helped to Americanize people and new people and underserved people in communities. But I started to notice also with the research over the last 3 years that it was almost incongruent that it was used as an assimilation tool, but it was also used as a safe haven from times when society became hysterical, say World War I, World War II. We hear about the World War II in the Crystal City, but this was happening again in World War I. That prefaced World War II, you know, little towns like Brenham and such. The German communities in these towns were having a lot of trouble with the KKK because they weren't speaking the language. They were reading German newspapers. They were still carrying out their German culture. Despite the fact that they were such an economic boom to these communities, the Anglo population in these communities had a big problem with them.
When you say Anglo, you mean basically English?
Actually, Anglos defined as those that migrated from the eastern part of the United States during the early 1800s. It's that group that Mexico would have brought in, that they brought in initially to defend themselves, or not defend themselves, but more block themselves off from Indian attacks. This Anglo population is the one that moved in. It's the Stephen F. Austin population, basically, that old 300 population. And once the German community came in, they took over the agricultural business, and farming and baseball and agriculture, baseball and farming went together hand in hand. David Vaught, the head of history at A&M, has a great book out there called Baseball, a Farmer's Game, that talks a lot about that. But with all of the culture that the German community had with the Vereinas and the fraternal organizations, baseball fit into their lifestyle perfectly. It fit into the rhythm of harvests. It fit into a lot of things. David Vaught talks about laid-by time. And they used it, like you say, to Americanize, but they also used it to kind of wall themselves off at times and keep their community solid together, you know.
So this was also a part of isolation.
Yeah. I mean, they used it as
but
a
they would come in and you know, come together on Sunday and play a game of baseball.
And they didn't have to worry about what was going on in society, all the white noise from society at the time. On Sundays, just like with the African-American community, just like with the Tejano community, they were able to use baseball kind of as that relief point.
Okay, I'm going to take a call here. The number is 210-614-8980, and Bennett is on the line. Bennett, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
It's interesting to listen to your guest. If I grew up in New York, and our neighbors prior to World War I, had a beer garden, and they were open Nazis. They used to get together once or twice a week and literally sing Nazi songs. And on December 8, 1941, the FBI came in and closed down that beer garden. And yet those people were not interned during the entire war. Just a contrast.
Okay, Bennett. So, yeah, we knew that the Bund was very active leading up into World War II.
That was a question that came up quite a bit yesterday at the presentation, was how did they decide who, as large as the German population was in the United States, how did they decide which individuals and which families were going to go to these internment camps that were throughout the country? So
Ed, you want to join that? Do you have any input?
Well, yeah. Actually, J. Edgar Hoover had a list of ABC potential people that he wanted interned in that progression. It's interesting to know about the beer garden. And not every German speaker is a Nazi. And that's really I've been pushing for the whole membership of the Nazi Party should be published, so people can no longer call somebody a Nazi, because at Nuremberg, the Nazi Party was declared criminal, and any member thereof was thereby rendered a criminal. And I kind of represent being in that same category. And at my hearing, everything was hearsay. Somebody would say, well, let's see, you were at the German-American picnic at Coney Island? Yes, I was. Well, nobody knew who was the accuser. There was no accuser in the hearing. No names were given. You couldn't refute anything. Somebody can just say that my father listened to German shortwave radio. Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But there was no real proof you couldn't refute anything.
Did you have a lawyer?
Oh, yeah, lawyers were prohibited by the Department of Justice took pride in the fact that lawyers were prohibited, said that, hey, it was easier that way, and it really was. My arrest warrant says, arrest Eberhard Ernst Friedrich Fuhrer for detention and for internment, not after a hearing or anything like that. But I did have a hearing, but it was totally meaningless, and the courts agreed that we were not even entitled to hearings to begin with.
The Japanese team that you played across from, what was the relationship like?
Oh, that was good. We had a good relationship with each other in Crystal City. You know, we could partake of their cultural events, and they could come to our cultural events. We had six Japanese in our concert band orchestra.
Last time I was at Crystal City, there are placards there marking that it was a Japanese internment camp, but nothing about the Germans. Has that changed?
Yeah, the state of Texas has now put up a monument stating that there, you know, the Germans and Japanese were interned at the place. The Japanese put that monument up themselves, and they called it a concentration camp, but believe me, it was not a concentration camp. It was an internment camp where nobody was hurt, nobody was killed, nobody was abused, and it was an internment camp.
But certainly the confinement took its toll. I know that it was very hard on your mom.
Well, my mother was 52 years old when she was arrested and interned, and nobody should be interned at that age. And she was told, look, you know, your youngest son, born in Cincinnati, has to go into internment, or we'll put him in an orphanage. And that's kind of a Hobson's choice that nobody can really make.
All right, we're out of time. Eb, it was great speaking with you again, sir. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Eb.
It. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.